Life is a huge, rich field of diversity of events inwardly, and that can reveal to us much insight. So insight can come in the dream world as much as in the daily life world. So there is no inhibition to that, and I would say therefore it includes dream. Did you ask?
There's another mic over there. Yeah, over here.
I just want to add a quick word that we often have a concept of awakening as a kind of shutdown, that we close everything down and awakening becomes a kind of ground zero. And this really isn't the case. It's much more that awakening is kind of endless openness rather than closing things. The endless openness that is able to be with beyond boundaries, so everything can arise.
Yes, at the back, please.
The question is, the questioner said, I'm a bit confused between desire and impersonal love, non-personal
passion.
Passion
and love.
But personal is there, right, in the word.
Yes,
personal.
Yeah,
yeah. And,
In general, and the non-personal
in general. Impersonal. So, there are powers of the heart. The question, I think I got it right. I don't know, I'm not 100% sure. Between...
Are you married? Yeah. That's the question.
Someone who's on a Buddhist plane and he's married.
I can't understand
his personal relationship. How does it connect the impersonal? Thank you. Obviously. If it's so, I can have anyone, man or woman, son. So I'm even more confused.
So the question is, to make it simple, the relationship between personal and impersonal love. How are the two connected together? Why? And the question to me, if I'm married, why am I married to one person? Or how does that fit with spiritual life? I think you really need to look carefully. We have this word, love, ahava, And it's so much not really understood or explored to the depth. But if we really, really touch and really explore and really look at the process going inside us called Ahava, love, it is a power. It is a power that all of you may experience, the sort of ecstasy of love when you fall in love with somebody. This power, when you fall in love with somebody, has an address. That address is coming up to you as a person, as a lineage, and all that power is kind of collected together around that person and that person's image. But it doesn't mean to say that the power itself is collected, is close, is in the address. It's just directed by, very often, sometimes quite painful attachments. And there's a pain in that. But the same love, the same power is potentially infinite. And when slowly, slowly you understand that power, it can begin to spread out and further and further and further and further. The address of love can become the whole world, including yourself. And it is not in conflict with married life. Why should it be in conflict? It is expanding the power to connect you with the heart, with the world. And so just watching that process where it's closed into an address or open with no address, will teach you this.
Well, the only thing I have to add on that is that when you love, you know. And when you love, there's no fear there. And all this questioning about the personal and the impersonal, it's like one thing that is a bit remote from the actual activity of the heart. Christopher was talking the other day about boundaries. And I think it was then that you said that the heart knows no boundaries. And it's a very profound truth, and we sometimes can touch it and experience it when love is there. I'm actually curious about the place that this question come from, but we don't have time really to go into it now. But I was just sort of suggesting to track it back and see where is the love now for you.
I'm just whispering. Essentially, two of us are married on the stage, and mine isn't. This is the one that isn't. Generally speaking, religion has and continues to have, including Buddhism, a lot of difficulty understanding passion and romantic love. And religion is sometimes rather denied or repressed or ignored or viewed as sensation. from the power of love, which Stephen just referred to, it has a significant ethic to it, because it moves us, and sometimes it moves us so strongly, such as being in love and falling in love, has such a power that it sometimes seems extraordinarily impersonal. One didn't wake up in the morning and say, well, I choose to fall in love today. The force of love moves the life. And in that respect, it can be extraordinarily impersonal in its movement and in its expression. The precious element with regard to love is it requires a great deal of wisdom and clarity from the lover. It also requires a great deal of wisdom and clarity about the loved. And in the dynamic of the lover and the loved, there is tremendous potential for the expansion of love, for insights to come. And the key element in all of this for the human being with life is, as much as possible and in the deepest place in our heart as possible, to forever to stay true to love. Question, please? Yes, there's one here before me. Yes, sir.
Question one. But how does it explain why do I and we all have this need to know what we need to do in life, to know who we are, to understand ourselves, to I have huge amount of dealing with this. Like, how
The question being asked here is, why do we have this need to know who we are or what we are doing with our life there? And then, and I have a huge amount, and I didn't catch the last bit.
I deal with it a lot.
Okay. Yeah, right. And I have a huge amount, and I have to deal with it a lot. Are all human beings concerned with who they are and what we're doing with our life?
No.
Somehow, if some insights and realizations had come about that, somehow the world would be somewhat different. But it's still up to us to explore those two questions. What really matters? Who am I? What is this existence about? And it's not to come to a conclusion, I may say, of arriving in some great state of unknowing. Human beings can know who they are, can see the direction, can see what matters, can live that through. We have power. But it gets forgotten.
And maybe sometimes what helps it to get forgotten is the why itself. Move the why away from the way. We are left with the core of the question, which is much more interesting, maybe also scary. So just to check if you're going to the whys that are around the thing, and a lot of energy spent there, and just diving directly to the heart of the matter.
that next question.
Are there any shortcuts?
I missed the word.
Substances.
Or meeting a fun individual, and if you can't answer on this, so I would be happy to be here. I assume you went through a lot in your spiritual path, so what was the leap, tipping point? What was the element, the problem? For those of us who are very lazy for meditating on this.
So the question is, are there shortcuts in this whole story? And some examples were given as substances, meeting this absolute guru that you've been dreaming all your life to meet. and actually was specifically asking, I don't know if you were asking, I guess you were asking Christopher because he was holding the microphone. To all of us, yeah? About what was the leap for each of us then? Well, you know, I had a time in my life when I believed there were shortcuts, and I believed that I had them, and it was done, and that was in the 60s. there is a shortcut. And the shortcut is absolute. And the shortcut is, if you fully know this moment, then that's the shortcut. You don't need any other moment. There is no other shortcut than that. The moment is the shortcut. Because it's all there. But, that doesn't satisfy most of you, probably. It will just make you more confused and frustrated. And there's a sense of infinite, something infinite in this, something beyond time, something that the whole question of a shortcut begins to look, what do we need a shortcut for? From where to where? Where are we jumping? To what are we jumping? Do we know? If someone would say, I'll give you a shortcut, here, take this pill. Would we take it? Will we know where it takes us to? Do we know where we want to go? So, I think we need to be just, in a way, let go of the need for us that we're going somewhere, from somewhere, to a goal, which is a journey, which is long and difficult, which takes time, and we want to get there fast. That's the normal mind talking. And slowly, slowly, we may let go of that and begin to feel there's something infinite in this journey. This journey is bigger than you and me. This journey is not necessarily locked in the person and the mind that says, I want to get there. This journey may be bigger than any of us here, any one person, any one individual interpretation that I'm going from A to B. And I'm less and less interested in leaping. That doesn't mean to say I'm crawling. But I can say I'm dancing.
Oh,
Next question, please. Yes, sir, and then the good lady after. The first question is, there are extraordinary experiences. The second was, if we have them to a frequency that eventually we'll go over to that. It's not possible to, with experiences and the precious unusual kind of experiences, to keep repeating them. It's not in the world of human capability or human choice. One thing, though, is in the range of experiences, from the ones, the extraordinary ones, to the most ordinary ones, coming back to what Stephen said about being in the moment, that in the context of an experience of any event, that experience is full of potential to draw from it infinite number of insights and discoveries. And in that respect, even the most ordinary is filled with the extraordinary. The gap between the two is made by thought.
No, exactly. The question. Why is there experiences that we call normal, and during meditation sometimes experiences that are not normal? Yeah. I don't know exactly what you mean when you say not normal. I can try and guess. If maybe something happened, or you saw something you're not used to see, or experienced something you're not used to see, but to experience. But it doesn't really matter, because what makes the difference, really? It's a labeling. Like right now, when we sit here, we hear the muezzin singing in the background. That's a miracle. The fact that we can hear somebody so far away, the fact that we can hear, period. It's a miracle. For me it is. And when I'm tuned into that, every experience can be a miracle, if that's how I label it. I know I'm not answering your question. It's okay.
I think that the definition of ordinary, that is ordinary reality, we call it ordinary simply because we are with it for longer. That's all. We're just with it all the time, so we call it ordinary. And there was a question about dreams. So we say dreams are unusual, they're not reality. But you're there in a dream, but you're changed. Life is there in a dream, but it's changed. So this, we wake up in the morning, usually we forget it. But I had a strange dream last night. That's non-ordinary. But it's just because we define it as a dream and we put it away. What about this dream right now? This dream right here, right now. Ordinary or not ordinary?
Question, please. Yes. Yes, sir.
My question is,
Did it didn't catch you?
All sorts of fun.
Well, so I said, one for you as well now. Go on, yes, sir, wait.
This was not part of the deal.
It wasn't part of the deal, I know. In a few minutes' time, they may vote to have us off, and then you'll be here. Anyway, go on, sir. I hope this is not a judgmental comment on all these people. Shepherds. In England, they look after sheep. I'm not sure. Might be different here. I'd like to put in a very good word for confusion. And confusion, the way I look at it, and when I inwardly and outwardly, is that there can be points in our life where the past doesn't seem to have any real place or usefulness or function. That it's the feeling inside is been there, done that. And there is a sense, therefore, to move on from. But one doesn't know what to move on from. To move on to. Consequences that there is some confusion inside. The old isn't working. I do not know what the new is that will to come in. And I'm in this kind of space or realm or confusion with some thoughts, obviously, between the two. But once again, that very confusion that one is has infinite possibilities to change and open things up in a way that past habits and past ways of being don't. So just wish to put in a good word for confusion. But you said have needs the. We passed the microphone. Do you want the microphone?
I didn't
understand
the question.
No, most of us didn't. It was about confusion and we were confused. So, but did you want to ask, have the same question? Yes.
Yeah.
Biography. Still a question.
Ah, right.
So I spoke long enough.
Of course.
Of course.
Next question.
Experience, theories of confusion. Sure.
What would you like to ask about thoughts and wisdom?
I'm not sure if I can summarize the points that you were making, but the general thread is about the relationship to thought and wisdom. Just two points I'd like to make here. To some degree, meditations that we've been engaged in here over the days, to some degree, contributes to minimizing thinking. Thinking means words, ideas, concepts, thoughts, imagination, speculation, views, and opinions, etc. To reduce that conceptual mental activity. For the purpose of getting closer to whatever is arising, closer to the moment, closer to the breath, closer to the earth. So there is a significant practice of the reduction of thinking, because excessive thinking for a human being is stressful. it wears on the mind, it wears on the heart, and it wears on the body. As you pointed out, there are times when thought is necessary. And therefore, what is the wisdom to go with such thought? The first consideration is in this thought, is there anything harmful whatsoever? Is such as selfishness, and greed, and putting oneself up, putting oneself down, negativity, blame, and the whole catastrophe. So a wise human being, noticing a stream of thoughts or a pattern of thoughts, will firstly look at the ethic. Is there anything harmful in this way of thinking? That's the first. If one sees that there is, it's painful and hurtful for oneself or for others or for both, then the challenge and the task is, what will help to change that way of thinking? Do I just need to see it and let it go? Do I need to bring loving kindness to my thinking? Do I need to see the space between the thoughts? Do I need to remember a thought is just a thought? Do I need to remember I've just identified and caught up with thinking? That's the wisdom, which is looking at thought and not in any way wishing to feed any unhealthy, unhelpful thought. There are thoughts which are not in the field of ethics, but those thoughts as well can be drifting thoughts, wandering thoughts, daydreaming thoughts, fantasizing thoughts, nothing harmful in them. But the question might be, when all of this daydreaming thinking that's going on, what am I missing out on? Am I missing out on life? Am I missing out on this moment? Am I missing out what it is to be a human being? Am I living in a false, deceptive world of thoughts and ideas and daydreams and trapped in all of that? Finally, there are thoughts, which you referred to briefly, which does require application and use. The thought of inquiry. What is love? What is truth? What matters? But also, there are the necessary thoughts when we wish to analyze, to really use our mind. And at times, we do need to quietly think about something to help understand it, to help get a handle on it, to expand our knowledge. And we have a fine networks, of course, of fine scholars and political analysts and people who do their research, and pundits, and people inquiring and asking questions and giving reports and doing some extraordinary work. Why are they doing it? Because they're thinking. And they're using their mind well when it contributes to the welfare of our species and our planet. So, the world of thought has a vital place when used well, and we use it well when we understand thought and when we have the quiet power to apply thought, and we have the same quiet power to let it go when we know it's not useful.
So, briefly, I just remember some research that may be interesting for you all, that there's been, of course, thousands of scientific research on the brains of meditators. And it's interesting that there's no spot in the brain that is blown up and expanded as a result of meditation. What meditation tends to do is what's called increase coherence. Coherentio, is that right? That means that there's, in the brain of meditators, the brain tends to all be working together. More parts of it are lit up. For example, the right brain and the left brain. Thought is very left brain dominated. So the left analytic commenting brain that is trying to work things out in using thought balanced becomes balanced by the right brain, which is much more global, intuitive, less boundaries, more creative, in a way, less analytic. And these two become balanced in the brain of meditators. So what I'm trying to say here is that the issue is that, I'm saying what Christopher said, slightly different language, the issue is the dominance of thought, not the not thought itself. And there's a word in the Pali called yoniso manasikaram. Is that
yoniso manasikaram?
Manasikaram. It means wise attention. That what we attend to, that we become. That's a sort of strong statement from the Dharma. Whatever we pay attention to, that's what we become. And wise attention is attention on many levels of a human being, just what we've been doing here. So, for example, we forgot that we have a body, we forgot that we have a head, unless we have a headache. So here we're relearning, the intelligence of the body. The way I can connect my feet. My feet are connected to the ground as I walk. And the life of the body. That becomes yoniso manasikaram. That becomes important. And that makes the balance in our consciousness. And so we can then apply this balance to actions in life. Not just through thought, but a much more balanced, broad approach, which can often be the wisdom can show us often much more clearly how we navigate menajet in life. But we don't trust it because we're so busy with thinking. We forgot how to use it.
Maybe a few more words about it. Somehow we think, or this a habit thinking, that if we have a problem and we think about it a lot, then somehow we get to solve it. And I think that's like a common denominator, you might say, like hanachat yesod. I don't know how to call that.
Premise.
Yeah. This, if we give it enough time, if we have a problem or we need to solve something, we just think about it, then we'll arrive to the solution. And often, I think we can see it quite clearly in these days here, but also from life. Life teaches us that often it's not the case. And more often, actually, the contrary. When we actually let go of this obsessive thinking, then there's a chance to wisdom to come in and sprout. And sometimes it's in the most unexpected places, but it comes actually when we release something, when we see something, when something is even stopped within us, then wisdom can have a chance.
Question? There are two people been waiting.
Yes. I was talking to you.
Please.
רציתי לשאול, בהנחה שאנחנו חייבים שאנחנו משחררים ומפגרים על הסיפורים שלנו ועל הדרמות, מה אנחנו יכולים לשים בקופיות?
Do you want to say the voice the question?
על כשמחליטים להפסיק עם הסיפורים והדרמות וכל זה, אז מה מחליטים לשים בפנים במקום? So when we decide to stop with our dramas, action, all that, what do we decide to put instead of that? Because it creates some kind of void and sadness, also, you said before, right? So what do we put inside instead of the stories and dramas?
I'm not quite convinced it's necessary to get rid of the dramas and the stories of life. I'm not quite persuaded of the idea, I must say. What I would say is that dharma is the freeing up of life. Its intention is to free it up. And if in the freeing up, it frees up and places into consciousness dramas and stories, I say, so be it. That's what's being freed up at this moment. And if we can touch the deep, there is no particular freeing up that will take place. Life is constantly in the capacity to keep freeing itself up. We can free up the heart, we can free up the mind, we can free up love, we can free up speech, we can free up body. And I don't see any particular with regard to this. And it might be that there has to be a patience. So the drama and the story may go. It would be a terrible pity the drama and story went and then we became rather nice, polite people. Get the land and enjoy the land of the living dead. So the freeing up is an endless freeing up and freeing up and freeing up. And sometimes we have to be patient with all of that. And I was just reminded just a moment ago, and Stephen just referred to Yoniso Manisikara. And Asaf, who is sitting here, I regularly send him emails, he's a sweetheart, with some Pali words, because he knows the Pali and he explains meanings of phrases and terms. So I have to get this fairly correct because he's sitting here. But Yoni, how do you project? Let me ask.
I wouldn't know how to say that. I don't remember.
So Yoni is something that comes from the womb. You have this, comes from the deep. Mani, like mind.
Yes,
mani. Mani. Sakara, kara, like action. So what's precious in life is the freeing up of the actions in life coming from the deep, coming from the womb of life. And we're interested in that. It might be called love, it might be called creativity, it might be called passion, it might be called interest, but it's to free up something in the being. And if in the process, as I said, the freeing up is some drama or story, so be it.
And I think we ought to actually add an understanding that it often it's not the story that's the issue, but the identification with the story. That when the story is needed to be me, for example, the role, I am a Roy Hachon, I'm the accountant, that's my story, I relate to it. In England they have this class structure, in India even more, where everyone, you know, is really defined by their class and by their story and by their family and by their birth. When the story is very connected to the self, it's me, it's my story, there's a lot of holding around that. When that softens, we can often feel a bit empty because the self is it becomes a bit empty. We're not sure who we are without hanging on to that story. And that can feel a little bit like shaky for a time. But very soon we realize we're much better off without the identification. And it's, I think Christopher said, patience. It needs maybe sometimes a little bit of time just to readjust. Just like when we come out of a retreat. When we come out of a retreat, you can feel a little shaky because maybe some things have dropped. This whole room here is a great big rubbish bin, pachashpa, of all sorts of stuff that we left here. And we can feel, oh, I lost some stuff. And I don't know quite who I am now. But so it's the changes in that we have hang on less to story. We hang on less to story, and then we can get the period of feeling a little bit empty, but it's temporary, and then hopefully something bigger fills that space.
Okay. My question is, I want to go back to the use of substances, if possible. And I know, right now. Now, I know the precepts say don't use any substance that will change your consciousness, but I also...
No, it doesn't. But so, carry on.
Okay. And then I will be happy for more and more corrections. I know that many traditions, especially ancient ones, or traditions like the shamanic traditions in Peru use ayahuasca, use it not as a, you know, like a party drug or something to hang out during the night, but as an essential steps along the spiritual path, a step that helps you to develop your conscious, to understand the world better sometimes. Mm. And I'm interested to know, why does the, at least what I thought, that there is the precept that said don't use these kind of things, or what is your opinion about like using these kind of plants as steps on a spiritual path?
The plant expert.
I thought this one would be thrown on me my way. I've had a lot of experience with plants of different kinds, mostly writing books about them, but also using all kinds. I have a great respect for the relationship with plants, and I think that we can use everything wisely. It's really not using, it's more having a relationship, which is wise, with the substances in the world. That means our relationship with the world built on something wise, something beneficial and helpful. So I personally don't see a big problem with the decision to explore this in a limited way. My own view, other people will argue with me about that, but in a limited way with a certain purpose, which is, if you like, sacred or clear, then it can be helpful. But it's also a high risk kind of path. It's high risk. It can easily go wrong, it can easily get a habit, it can easily lose its power, and become something routine. And one big problem is it can be instead of something really homegrown inside us, which needs nothing, which needs no help from anywhere. And it can often be replaced that. And I think that is where the fifth, the importance of the fifth precept is. It isn't, the fifth precept, as I understand it, is really against sort of undoing our spiritual capacity, undoing it by this kind of thing, which is replacing it with substances and thinking that, you know, we've got somewhere, when actually it might be weakening our own inbuilt capacity to reveal things. So it's very delicate, the whole thing. And that's the way I understand the fifth precept. And if you understand it similarly, Christopher, you know.
The language, oh, sorry. I think you're referring to this fifth guideline, the actual language of it. The word pamada is used. So it means it's the training to not to take that which contributes to carelessness through, specifically in this case, through alcohol and fermented things. So that's the reference for it. And I just want to fully agree, in fact, with Stephen, that in wise company and sensitive, respectful spiritual conditions, some people do find ayahuasca being one of them, find those kind of experiences helpful and valuable. And as Stephen also mentioned as well, but just again to be mindful that the impact of that which is digested or swallowed or smoked or whatever can, for some people, have quite a damaging impact there. And that would be the concern. So let's take two more questions. And yes.
Confidence. One of the words I love the most in Pali. It's actually a quality that is coming out and is also something to cultivate, to help it come out. And you can look at it in many different ways, but one of them is when you start tasting the fruits, then it's easy. Then it's easy. Confidence just, you know, there. When you are in a confused state, this word, actually, in, you can call it trust, you can call it emun, bitachon, זה איזושהי מילה שהיא מחברת את כל אלה ביחד, אבל היא גם הרבה יותר מזה, יש בה גם את it has the passion of the heart as well. And that can come to our help in times of confusion, in times that we are not feeling really connected to the path, we may be forgetting what are we doing it for or why are we doing it and all that. And so many of you expressed these voices over the days here. So this kind of quality can come to our assistance. There's a quiet confidence that is being צומחת, כשהחוכמה מעמיקה, and the wisdom is deepened, when clarity is revealing itself. And it's both something you are aiding it to happen and also something that is carrying you forward. It's what's come to my mind right now.
In the duality, for instance, outer and inner for a moment, sometimes wisdom shows, going to the outer for the moment, the real lack of confidence in. And the obvious sort of thing could be some of our political masters, bankers, whatever. So there is a real place, sometimes in the external, with regard to not having confidence in. At times there is the turning back, especially here and elsewhere, and coming to the inner. And people will say, or too humanly and understandably, I don't really have confidence in myself. And my response to that, no, but why should you? Why should a human being have to have confidence in their self? What's the big deal about the self having confidence? And so the I arises, and the I, the self, in its appearance in consciousness, is constantly and regularly concerned with lack of. I want more of. And no matter how much more of one gets, there is still more of to get. And the self is never satisfied. And confidence is one of those commodities which we hunt for in the inner life. I'm not sure if that's a healthy or wise direction to go in. So the deeper question would be, what is confidence without any self-interest?
There's one last thing that comes to my mind now. When the Buddha was awakened, he thought it's going to be too difficult to explain this part, because it's so subtle. Maybe you can see for yourself. But somebody convinced him to do it. He was just teaching that day, last week, to a group of DFP people. A being called Brahma Sahampati tried to convince him and succeed to do it. And the Buddha said, okay, I will teach. I will help those with just a little dust in their eyes. And then he spontaneously, that's in the text, uttered some poetry and blessing. And he blessed all of us, past, present, future. And he said, may all those who have ears to hear, to listen, meaning all of us sentient beings here, will release the trust, the confidence. And that, for me, is a signpost that we have this quality inside of us, in a maybe sometimes caged, but it's actually in our hands to let it free, to let it go, to embody us, if you like. So that's the blessing the Buddha was blessing us. May all those with ears release that quality. Let it be free in us.
finish then. Let's call it to finish it.
Yeah.
So we have a unanimous vote here to finish on that point. Good, such a sweet point. Thank you, Leela. Thank you very much for the lovely questions. And of course, in the exchange and the discourse that takes place, a person's question, maybe our own question, a response which comes from us or from within, may well be worthwhile giving some wise attention to, some application of useful thought to, and sometimes a little bit more gets revealed. And revelations, there's an abundance of them. And may we keep our eyes and hearts and ears open for the multiplicity, the infinite number of that which can be shown to us. Let's have a quiet minute, shall we?